This message was recorded live at Lighthouse Christian Center in Puyallup, Washington, and is designed to inspire and encourage you in your Christian journey. To find out more about Lighthouse, check out our website at www.lighthousehome.org.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be with you this morning. Hello, Lighthouse. Bear with me. My voice this morning is a little deeper. Actually, I'm just fighting a little bit of a cold. I kind of like the sound of it a little bit better. Makes me feel a little bit more like Charlton Heston, perhaps. I wasn't expecting the bridge jumping thing. Larry asked me before the service, and I'll tell you one bridge jumping story. I jumped bridges when I was younger so that people would go, wow, how could he ever do that? I was stupid, foolish kind of a thing. I've ceased doing that. But one time I jumped off a bridge on the little North Fork River, Saniam, coming out of sight of Salem, Oregon. It was a span, one of these old span bridges down into this narrow cavern. And I was with some buddies, and I thought, you know what? I need to impress these guys. And so I hoisted myself to the top of the span, little foot and a half section up there. The river looked like it was, 4 feet across way down there. And I jumped off. Had a little bit of a hole in my shoe, and I was, when you're airborne, there's nothing better. It's very, very nice. It just doesn't last very long. You hit the water, and the water cut my shoe, and my shoe ended up around my thigh. The seams on my shorts both split up to my waistband, and I slapped myself pretty good. I thought, I don't know if I should be doing this kind of stuff. You don't know this, but we are distantly related. I have been following Lighthouse since you began. I remember when I heard about this guy starting a church in Puyallup, Washington on Saturday nights, and I scratched my head and I thought, what is that about? Why would anybody ever do that? That didn't make any sense to me, and obviously it seemed to work pretty well. Also, I know that you guys have had a significant hand in helping a church called Journey Church in Tacoma, Byron O'Neill there. The church is a couple years old now and thriving. You guys have had a significant investment in that church. Was in your lobby last night, saw Travis Reed, who's planting a church in Juneau, Alaska, up on the board there. And these are all guys that I have had the honor of working with over the last couple years. And so it's an honor to share that value with you guys. I know the staff is away, and so I actually saw that as a potential opportunity for you as a community this morning to make some changes here at Lighthouse. I thought we'd just begin by, in fact, last night I talked to a young man. His name is Ben Capulis. I mean, some of you know Ben. His family is really involved in children's ministry. I said, what do you need to change around? What do we need to change? And he said, we need a pool out back. And so we voted last night. We're going to vote this morning. All those in favor of a pool out back, so raise your hands. All those opposed? Just one. I'm sorry. I'm just kidding. Okay, just like last night, the pools have it. So I think Art was a little worried about having me come up. Not so much that we would change things, but because of the way I typically dress. He actually didn't give me a dress code. But I'm wondering if you'd do me a favor. If after I'm done today, I don't care if you really say anything to Art about my talk, but if you would somehow approach Art and say, man, that guy knows how to dress. Or if you take a second and you say that and then you look at him, and then you kind of move on or something like that. I would be very grateful to you if you would do that, because I know he was a little bit worried about how I might show up this morning. We don't know each other, but I would like to invite you and maybe ask permission to talk about what could, for many of us here this morning, be a little bit of a heavier subject. I think these times when we come together, we need to make the most of them and to look into God's Word and ask serious questions about life and about following Jesus. The question I would like to ask this morning has to do with the idea of, does God really know what He's doing in our world, and perhaps even more specifically, does he know what he's doing in my life? I look at the war in Iraq, I look at how broken our world is, I look at issues around, I go, does God, do you really understand all the time? This becomes very personal when we look inside of our own hearts. When I look inside my own heart, I see brokenness in my life. And I say, God, really, do you know what you're doing in my life? And how do I cooperate with you? And as a pastor, I meet people too frequently whose lives are falling apart. The wheels are completely coming off. They pray earnestly that God will show up and save the day, that God will somehow rescue them from very difficult circumstances, and they wait, and he doesn't show. I met a man just a few weeks ago at a church kind of a thing, and he was a broken man because his marriage was falling apart. What made this very difficult for him is his wife had taken his children, hired a lawyer, and in an effort to get custody of the kids, full-time custody, and X him out completely, she brought a lawsuit that he was abusing the kids. And good man, follows Jesus. It wasn't working, the whole physical abuse thing. Somehow, through the legal wrangling, it looked as though that she wasn't getting the kind of ground that she was looking for. And so then she entered in sexual charges against him, against his own children. The wheels are completely falling off. I know of another family, both parents raised in the church, young couple, young married couple, two children. And wanted more children and prayed for a long time. They had a difficult time conceiving and having a child. And you can imagine the elation that they experienced when, lo and behold, they ended up with child. She was pregnant, excited, gave birth to a healthy baby. One night, husband is away on work trip. And somehow, there's some sort of a noise in the nursery. They go in, the baby has stopped breathing. She desperately pulls the child out of the crib, puts it on the floor. The other two little children come running in. And she's crying out to God, if you show up now, my child will be, could you help us right now? And she's mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, CPR. The other kids are watching this scene. And the child dies. Or the woman who, through time, watches her husband's soul being slowly choked out by a pornography addiction. You can feel the intensity of their relationship as it begins to cool and dwindle. Does God really know what he's doing in these circumstances? When these kinds of things happen in our life, and when you follow Jesus for a long time, eventually, either in your life or in somebody's life very close to you, the wheels will come off and they will feel like God has not shown and not rescued them. And all kinds of thoughts begin to swirl around. We have this sense of despair that begins to develop inside of us. Some of us here this morning have had something tragic happen to us in our past where we cried out to God and he didn't show up. And it was like there was a wound and now a scar there that we've never really dealt with. We have distanced ourselves from God. We may still go to church. We may still sing songs, but we're resistant to trust him, to believe in him. This intense disappointment that God didn't show up for me. I mean, I thought we were having a personal relationship, that we're friends. God, is this how you treat your friends? Did I do something to deserve this? Are you punishing me? Are you angry with me? Is this the life of blessing that you promised? I mean, hard questions. Can I really trust God? Do I really believe in him when the wheels are falling off of my life? This is the kind of situation that I want to talk about today. Two single women and their brother. If you have been around a church for very long, their names are Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. They're very unique people because they of the intensity or the closeness of their relationship to Jesus Christ. You see, Jesus gathering fame, the crowds thronged to him. He was on speaking tours. He would go out. He would get very exhausted. And when he was tired and needed a retreat, as a celebrity, he went to his closest friends. He went to Mary, Martha's, and Lazarus's house. Very tight. They lived in a place called Bethany. Now, Mary and Martha knew Jesus. They knew that he had, to a complete stranger, a blind man he had never, ever met, he just walks up to this blind man, and there's this dialogue and exchange, and Jesus ends up taking some mud with some water and wiping it on his eyes, and the blind man could see. He healed him. Mary and Martha knew this. They knew Jesus as the man who had power and authority over all of creation. They knew that he walked on water. They knew that he calms storms, that he rebukes the wind and the waves when they're demonically driven. They knew that he was a very unique teacher. You see, Jesus was unique as a rabbi because he would actually teach women. Rabbis typically wouldn't teach women. But we know that Mary and Martha, Jesus was teaching in their home, and there was Mary at Jesus' feet. I mean, very, very close relationship. Martha, if you don't know Mary and Martha, Martha was the busybody of the two, typically, and she wasn't as concerned about Jesus' teaching so much as making sure that all his needs were met, but they were very tight, like brothers and sisters might be. And so the scene that I want to look at with you today, it's actually found in John chapter 11. Listen as I tell you what's happened. You see, Lazarus is sick. And in three verses, this text says that he's sick. And it says then again, he's sick. I mean, he's very sick. He's a sick guy. First century, no doctors to speak of. When people got sick, you had to kind of ride it out. You had maybe some herbal kinds of things, and people would come and pray and anoint people with oil when you were sick, but you really didn't have a lot of hope sometimes. You kind of had to ride these things out. This is the context for our story today. So Lazarus is sick. The mood is a bit somber. Things don't look good. So, with a sense of confidence, Mary and Martha they say, well, we know Jesus. Let's call out to Christ. Let me read the verses to you. And let's kind of see if we can visualize this story together. John chapter 11, verse 1 says these words. Now, a man named Lazarus was very sick. He was from Bethany, a village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, and here's a little insight that John plugs into this text. This is the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. Interestingly, you have to turn pages deeper into the gospel to even see this story happen. John is assuming we know the stories of Mary and Martha. Scholars will tell you that perhaps Mary is the first of Jesus' friends, the first among all of his disciples to actually understand that Jesus has come to die on a cross. This whole anointing scenario many believe, I mean, she's anointing him for death. A huge act of love. This is the Mary we're talking about. She says, with a sense of confidence, so the sisters sent word to Jesus, Lord, the one you love, I mean your friend, Lazarus, he's very sick. Now, it's the right thing to do when we face crises in our lives to go to God and to anticipate an answer, to say, God's going to come and he's going to answer my prayers. And we know from the scriptures, we know that God is always present, though not always evident. We know post the resurrection that Jesus says, "And lo, I will be with you even unto the end of the age." And so while he's present, sometimes the evidence of his availability seems very distant from us when we're in a deep and tragic crisis. What's hard about this is some of us, perhaps, have been told that if I simply trust Jesus, if I simply give my life to Jesus, if I give myself away to him, I mean, my life will be blessed. God will always save the day. I remember one prof, I used to use these words, he used to say, God will rarely save your bacon until it's crisp. You know, that kind of an idea. And it plugged into the back of my brain. It's like, God will always show up. But sometimes, it doesn't seem like he's there. How does this work for us? But what happens when we cry out for Jesus and he doesn't show? Strange thoughts begin to swirl around in our brains. So, Mary and Martha, they send word. They dispatch a messenger to Jesus. He's out. He's not that far away. And obviously, we're very dear to him. He's going to drop everything, drop the speaking tour, and he's going to come running. So they dispatch the messenger, and they then alternate caring for Lazarus and keeping an eye right on the horizon, knowing that any moment, Jesus, you can just see him walk up over the horizon, and he will save the day. And one day passed, and then the next day passed. And then all of a sudden, something happened with Lazarus. Things became desperate. You see, when somebody begins to die, chemical reactions, stuff happens to the skin, and you begin to sense that death is close. This is where Lazarus is at. The women become desperate to see Jesus. They wait, and they wait, and never in their minds did they believe that somehow Jesus wouldn't come up. And all of a sudden, Lazarus, his heart and his chest begin to move differently, and they sense they're on the very last breath, the last moments of Lazarus' life, and he breathes his last breath, and then he dies. He's dead. Jesus, meanwhile, knows the messenger made it, and he calmly stayed where he was. He didn't venture out to save the day. What was the problem? Mary and Martha. Perhaps the messenger didn't make it over there. Is something wrong with the messenger? Maybe Jesus didn't understand how desperate this was. Maybe the problem is with Jesus. Does he care about us? We call and we wait and he doesn't show. What do you think? When this kind of thing happens in your life, what do you believe? What do you see? What do you think? For me, I'm not the kind of person that says something's wrong with Jesus. I'm the kind of person that says something must be wrong with me. And perhaps you're like me. Maybe I'm not important enough. Maybe I'm not the kind of person that God... I'm a lesser important person in the family of God. Somehow I don't count as much. Or perhaps because God knows what I've done. You know I can count on my wife. When I'm in a jam, my wife, she's a wonderful woman. We met in high school, and she's just a sweetheart. And when I'm in a jam, I call her up and I say, "Honey, look, I lost my keys. Could you bring me another set of keys?" And she goes like this. She goes, "Are you kidding? Okay, all right." She's there for me. I mean, it's wonderful. I can always count on her. Even sometimes when I count on Jesus. You know what I'm saying? As I was thinking about this talk and about being with you, I thought about where we might be, and I thought to myself, maybe this is an appropriate place for me to confess a sin. You don't know me. I get to drive home after church today, and so I'm just going to take a moment and let you know that I sinned. You do too. So, I mean, it's not that big. I mean, we all do this. This is not an uncommon practice. Mosaic is a 4.5-year-old community. It's a great church. And we stand tall on the shoulders of a congregation called Portland Alliance Church, where for 70 or 80 years, they established themselves in the Hollywood District of Portland, and they planted ethnic churches around the city and around the region. They've been very involved. And as they aged as a community, they came to a place where most of them were mostly over 65 or 70. I can't believe the courage that this congregation expressed, because their elders kind of came together and they said these words. They say, and I can almost quote them verbatim, "The traditions that we love and the expression of faith that we hold so dear is no longer effective in our neighborhood. Somehow we've lost our ability to get any traction with people who are younger, and we're just not able to do that anymore. So on the basis of stewardship, we're going to not express a spirit of ownership. On the basis of stewardship, we're going to give our building to a church plant." Huge risk. Very courageous. I couldn't believe it, because I'm a church planting guy, and I've been the recipient now. There's 20 of us, and these people are going to give us their building. Now, great building, great location. A lack of, what do you call it, when you don't maintain a building well long term? You know, some of the maintenance stuff had gone astray. So we've been given the gift, so what we do is we say we now want to plant in this building and get it ready for another 40-year run. And so new heating and cooling, and we piles and piles of money into this building. It's the right thing to do. It's a great thing. We're getting to the end where we're making interior decoration types of decisions. And we have 5 different chairs now, comfortable chairs like this type. In fact, these chairs look roughly familiar to me. But anyway, 5 types of chairs, and we have to make a decision. It's time, because the pews are going to go. I mean, a lot of things were, you know, you get all backed up, and the designer needed to make the decision. And in the last moments, the business manager at the church, he said, "Randy, there's a chair at Multnomah Biblical Seminary and Bible School in their cafeteria that you really need to take a look at. Make sure that the designer gets to see that chair." And so I thought to myself, and I grabbed Kendra, we were together, and I said, "Let's go over to Multnomah, and would you ride up to see the designer with me? It's not typically what I do, but this, I was involved in this one, and I was enjoying it." So she said, "Sure." We drove over to Multnomah Biblical Seminary and Bible College into their cafeteria, and there were like 500 of these beautiful chairs. And I had come to borrow one of them, but there was nobody around. There was nobody to be seen. And I'm working on my phone, and I'm looking around, and have a phone conversation. And Kendra was like, "Let's." So I grab a hold of a chair, and I'll find somebody in the hall. And I walk down the hall, and there's nobody in. And so I walk out in the courtyard, and there's nobody around. And I have the chair. And so I just walk over to my truck. Nobody stops me. I just put the truck right, the chair right in the back of the truck, and you know. We're off, you know. We're off to see the designer. You know, I'm gonna hop onto 205, go over the bridge to Washington where he was, and on the way over, all of a sudden we're driving down the road, and all of a sudden my truck feels a little bit lighter. It's like, whoa! And I look in my rearview mirror, and I see why, because that chair from Multnomah Biblical Seminary and Bible College from the cafeteria is rolling down the freeway. And I look at Kendra, and I said, "Look what you've done." I said, "Why did you do this? You snake." You know, I'm like, what is she doing? I pull over, and you know, it's really a potential disaster. There's cars kind of, I'm like, and I've got beads of sweat on my head, and I'm pulling over, and I jump out of my truck, and I'm getting one of these adrenaline rushes, and so I'm out dancing in the traffic trying to pull this chair out of the, and it's ruined. It's destroyed. It was sturdy. It didn't fall apart. But it was just beat up. You can so imagine. And but nobody saw me take it. So I'm thinking, you know. So we go see the designer, and he shakes his head. He's a non-believing guy. And I asked him if he wanted it. I said, "Well, you can have it, you know." And I explained to him my dilemma. Anyway, I left it there. And I didn't say anything. I said a couple things to a couple people at staff. So don't tell anybody. Couple weeks passed. life goes on, busy, 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 you know, kind of thing, and all of a sudden, my conscience is pricked. It's like, oh, man, I need to come clean with this chair thing. It seemed to have pricked about the time one of the men from the church actually became the business manager at Multnomah Biblical Seminary and Bible College. So I had a friend now, but I'm ordering fabric to, you know, recover. I have one. I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to make restitution. Had some men in our church who had been praying before one of the services. They said the word restitution came to their mind, and I thought, yeah, that's for me. Now, I tell you that long, fairly benign, that's a benign sin. That's kind of funny. But I know this in this room. Most of us have secrets that we believe nobody knows except God. Some of us have secrets and things that we've done maybe even years and years ago where we wake up in the night and we still feel this, oh no, what's wrong? Why did I let that child go? Why did I visit that place? Why did I kiss that woman? And what happens sometimes is we become distant from God. And then when stuff starts to happen, we say, yeah, I deserve this. God is punishing me, or God doesn't love me enough, or I don't deserve His grace and His favor. And we make this about us. Now, I don't think this is what Mary and Martha are doing. But I know that when you and I face tragedy, sometimes we think, did I do something? Is this about me? This isn't about me at all. Lazarus is wrapped, anointed with all the right spices. He's placed in a tomb, and he lays there for day one, day two. People come from Jerusalem, the mourners come, they cry, they weep. Day three, in Jewish culture, you know, after 3 days, you know for sure they're dead. I mean, Lazarus is cold, he's stiff, his body is beginning to rot in the grave. Concerned, you don't open the grave, I mean, all these kinds of things. And all of a sudden, during this mayhem of mourning, when Jesus didn't show, you have a deeply disappointed Martha, a deeply disappointed Mary at the loss of their brother. We thought he was our friend. We thought he would show for us. 4 days in, guess whose silhouette begins to emerge on the horizon? Jesus. And what he does is he shows up, and before he can get to where Mary and Martha are, word gets out. And he ends up in two conversations. One conversation with Martha, and a second conversation with Mary. And in these two conversations, Jesus teaches us, and we learn who he is in a better way, which is what this is about, is it not? So the text, first conversation with Martha. Back to John chapter 11, verse 17. On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus has already been in the tomb for 4 days. Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews who had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him. These are very interesting words. But Mary, she stayed home. In a sense, she put her hand up. She said, I don't know if I can deal with him right now. He wasn't here. I don't know if I trust him the same way. I'm questioning my faith in who he is. I'm discovering in the midst of my tragedy, and I'm not sure I'm ready to see him. Martha comes out to Jesus, and she says, Lord, and here's the prayer. You can think of it, and she's speaking to Jesus. So think of it in these terms, that she's offering a prayer. Lord, if you had been here, why didn't you show up when I needed you the most? If you had been here, my brother would not have died. And then this glimmer of faith comes from her. She says, but I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. I love the complaint in my prayer, in her prayer. It's reminiscent of the Psalms when David pours his heart out and has this very raw, real, authentic conversation and dialogue with God in the midst of pain and suffering or loss or whatever it might be. It's honest. And Jesus says to her, Martha, your brother, he will rise again. I'm here to raise him from his tomb. Jesus knew what he was going to do. He knew all along what he was going to do. In fact, I'm not going to get into that portion of the chapter today. But later, you see what happens is, after these conversations with these two great women, and Jesus goes and raises Lazarus from the tomb. He comes out alive. It's a picture, perhaps, of really the events that are now in play in Jesus' life. You see, it was this event that caused the Jewish leaders to say, this guy has got to go. This is it. The plot to kill him just blossoms right out of this whole historic scene. Jesus says to Martha, your brother, he will rise again. Martha said, yeah, I understand theology, Jesus. I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day, some other time, you know, at the culmination of things. Jesus said to her, no, Martha, listen, slow down. I don't think she really got it, but this is what he says, very powerful words. I am the resurrection. I am the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. Do you understand, Martha, that this is about believing in me in the midst of the deepest struggles that you have? If you understand that I am the Messiah, that I am here, you need to know that regardless of whether you live or die, you will live because I am I'm the one who's going to take all the broken mess that has become of this world, that has become of our place, my life, my heart. I am going to make those things right. I am the resurrection. I am the life. You understand this, Martha? He says, and whoever lives and believes in me never dies. He's talking about a type of life that Martha can actually be experiencing in this moment of grief. And then he looks at her and he says these words. He looks at her deep and he says, Martha, do you believe this? Do you trust me in the midst of this very difficult moment? He's asking us the same question. When the wheels come off life and it seems like Jesus hasn't shown up, are we able to say in those hard, difficult moments, I don't know what's going on, I don't get it, but I believe in Jesus, and I'm going to rest that direction. Conversation number one. Conversation number two is with Mary. Verse 29. I'm going to back up verse 27. This is Martha's response. Yes, Lord, she told him, I believe that you are the Messiah. I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come into this world. And she expresses her faith in Jesus. Now, it's a Martha busyness type faith. She never stops very long sometimes. Mary's the more reflective one. She's back at the house. Verse 29. And after Martha had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. And she says these words, the teacher, he's here. She said, and is asking for you. And when Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. This is what I love about Mary. Disappointed, deeply discouraged. And yet when Jesus calls to her, she quickly gets up and comes running. And it's almost as if she comes, and I really appreciated what Larry had to say earlier. You know, we come when we want to open our hearts. It's kind of like this posture of, please help me understand. Please, I may be able to be honest with you, but I'm not going to go someplace else. I'm not in my destitute state going to go out and destroy my life. When Jesus calls, I'll come. And perhaps today, he's calling you from someplace of deep disappointment and discouragement.
The teacher is here, she said, and asking for you. When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house, comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said the same thing her sister said. Lord, if you had just been here, where were you? We needed you. Were you so busy that you couldn't come and care for? You love us. We've had you in our home. If you'd have just been here, my brother, he would not have died. And Jesus saw her weeping. Interesting thing happens. Inside of Jesus, I don't know for sure what he was thinking. But the text says that he was deeply moved. It has these very emotional kinds of words. You don't, you know, in the movies when you see Jesus, he's always kind of floating. You know, he doesn't smile, doesn't cry, just when he talks, he's just... This is not the Jesus of the Scriptures. This is a deeply emotional man, fully God, fully human, taking in this whole scene. And the text says this. It says that he was deeply moved in his spirit and troubled. When you step back to some of the original language, the idea has to do with a little bit of angst and anger and frustration and all these kinds of things. And my question is what is he so deeply troubled about? I mean, is he looking at Mary here weeping? And is he thinking to himself, Mary, you haven't had your devotions for a month. This is what happens when you stop praying and you stop reading your Bible, you stop fellowshipping up with people, you just hang out at the house. I mean, boy, you're hormonal today, aren't you? I mean, is he kind of going that kind of a route? I mean, the Bible doesn't tell us exactly what he says. So here's a couple of options. There's probably some truth to this. Death is a bad thing. We were not designed to die. It's the culmination of a broken thing, is death, is it not? Jesus is on a mission to conquer death and sin and brokenness and injustice and poverty. And here he is, stricken with this moment where this is so real to him. And it's like, ah! Or perhaps it's a reflection of his understanding that he is just days away from a cross himself, where he will be divinely abandoned for the first time in eternity, where fellowship with the Father will be completely stopped because of sin and injustice and destruction. You see, for God loved us enough that he would send Jesus to get on the point of pain and rejection physically, spiritually. He was here's Mary weeping at his feet, feeling disturbed, and all of a sudden, what happens is his own chest begins to swell, and he experiences tears, and they begin to run down his cheeks, and I don't think that he was just sniffling. He actually, the Bible says, he wept. Deep-seated hurt, anguish, frustration. Here's his friend at his feet, weeping because of the destruction of death in his own friend's life. He understands her, where she's at, which is to say, for you and for me here this morning, perhaps you're here and you feel like the wheels have fallen off and God has not shown up for you. You need to know that Jesus really understands. He is very empathetic to our circumstances. He gets it. He's not unfamiliar with pain. and loss and rejection. He gets all of those things. We don't have a Lord who is unsympathetic with the plight of humanity. He loved us enough to become human. And he took upon himself on the cross all the injustices of the world. Now, we've all been sinned against, and as a result, we all sin. And the reality is Jesus is not always evident, but he is always present post the resurrection. So I think he gets it. He's helping us understand that in the midst of it, do you believe in me? And he's empathetic. But I have a greater question. Why? Why does he do this? One of the reasons why is it's not about us. One last verse. 11, verse 4 says this. This is back earlier in the story when Jesus first heard word that Lazarus was dying and he decided to stay. This is what he told his disciples. He said, "This sickness will not end in death. Nope, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." You see, Jesus loved Martha and Mary and Lazarus very much. You see, this circumstance isn't about Mary and Martha at all. This is about the Messiah. This is a reality about following Jesus. You and I can never tell Jesus what to do, when to do it, how to do it. We have a very limited perspective, very self-centered. God understands what's going on in the cosmos. And it's all about eventually bringing glory to Jesus. Glory has the idea of reputation, about enhancing his reputation. And here's the beauty of this. Because he loves us so much, and he's knit his lives to us, his life to ours, he has bound up his reputation, his glory, his great name, his character, and his honor in how he treats us. And he will never treat us or abandon us in such a way that his name will ever be called into question. His reputation can never be divorced from what happens to us, says Carolyn James. John Piper says it this way, "It was God's good pleasure to join you and me to himself in such a way that his name is at stake in your destiny." God's glory, if you're a follower of Jesus, his name is at stake in your destiny. In such a way that you become a reflection upon his name. Your story, the journey of life that you are working through, will never put God to shame. It will only add in the end to the evidence of God's great goodness. Somehow, the mystery, the resurrection, the death, or just post-Easter, death and resurrection, in such a way that everything that's bad that's happened will be remade in such a way that the bad things will end up making the good things even better. You hear that? The pain and the struggle and the abandonment and the realities of a broken world through Jesus will only serve to make eternity even better. The beautiful thing about this for me is this. This is how I find hope. If I had a rope, I'd string it out. I'd take a rope and I'd string it all the way to the back of the auditorium here and around the side or whatever I could do. And I could say, this is how short and brief our life is. But this resurrection life begins now and ends for eternity. And the way we trust in Jesus today affects all of that. So, Emmanuel means God with us, even when it's suffering at its greatest. Jesus says, because I live, you also can live, even in the midst of the very difficult seasons.
We trust you are inspired and challenged by this message. For additional resources and information about Lighthouse Christian Center and its ministries, check out our website at www.lighthousehome.org or contact us at 253-848-2028.